Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today, this simple vegetable can flush environmental toxins from your body, and it does it very quickly. Also, Purdue University is studying about blueberries preventing bone loss in postmenopausal women. Artificial sweeteners may cause gut bacteria to change, not good, and a study about the healthy lifestyle and behavior can prevent 80% of all heart attacks and much more coming on health and nutrition. Then, five excellent new reasons to cut down on meat from Martha Rosenberg, and a commentary from John Stanton, Weekend Edition, President Obama doesn't speak for God, Mississippi sued over hellish conditions in for-profit prisons, and how much does your congressperson make per hour? It's staggering, because remember, they're not working all that many hours. Also, you'll hear from a person who decided to speak out about how we're approaching the different efforts in the Middle East. A different voice, a person who was there as a soldier speaks out. Let's begin. A clinical trial is showing that tiny sprouts, we're talking about broccoli sprouts, can help neutralize air pollution and its toxic contaminants in the body. If you live in any major city in the United States, you are exposed to various types of pollutants. Depending upon where that city is, you may not always see them. For example, in New York, you don't really see a lot of pollution, but it's here. It's just that the breeze takes it from the west to the east and out into the Atlantic. Whereas if you live in Los Angeles, you see the pollution as you come in over the mountains because it hangs over the city as smog. People suffer from air pollution every single day. Most people are not aware of what can happen. Well, one thing that can happen is it can increase cardiorespiratory deaths, asthma, pulmonary disease, and according to Natural Society, quote, chronic respiratory conditions, among other ailments. It also adds to less severe problems like allergies, colds, and flu. Now, according to the International Agency for Research on Cancer, they've recently classified air pollution as carcinogenic to humans. This is a first. Now, where I grew up in West Virginia, we had a lot of coal mines. And if you go into Kentucky, Tennessee, Ohio at the southern end, West Virginia, you'll find, and by the way, these are all very close together because they all merge on the Ohio River. They're all within 100, 150 miles of each other. So you'll see that you'll hear about black lung disease, and that's caused from the coal dust that they are breathing, not just in the mines, but also the whole communities have this. I never will forget when I lived in Wheeling, West Virginia for a while, and Weirton, West Virginia, which is right across from Steubenville. I came out one morning, and it had just snowed. The snow had only been on the ground for maybe an hour. And I had a car and an old Plymouth, and the entire car had snow on it, but it also had little tiny red flecks. And I looked at it, and it looked like someone kind of misty sprayed the car with red paint. So I went over and I picked up some snow and I looked, because normally you wouldn't see this. And I thought, wow, we're breathing this. And that led to me coming up with an invention, which I later took. They thought enough of it. They brought me in to meet with a Dr. Carson to see about using it as a way of scrubbing the toxins that come out of the smokestacks. I don't know if it was ever used. They never got back to me. I gave them a working model. But I decided I didn't want to live there anymore because then I started to pay attention. See, when you see red specks on white snow, you pay attention. But if you don't have the snow, then you don't see it so easily. So then I just began to observe that it was everywhere all the time. It was completely common for people working in the Kanawha Valley, which is near where I lived, to have diseases, much higher cancer rate. But again, there was no questioning it because the assumption was if there was a pollutant in the air, the authorities wouldn't allow you to work near it or be exposed to it. It would take a re-education in the reality of big business covering itself from its pollutants. So just be aware that now, according to Johns Hopkins University and some other institutions, that pollutants in the air causes cancer. But here's what the study was about. It was about broccoli sprouts. They did a 12-week randomized placebo-controlled study, and what they found was in one of the most polluted areas, broccoli sprouts were extremely effective. In this study, half the participants were asked to consume approximately half a cup of broccoli sprout drink every day, and the others drank a pineapple or lime juice. The results were published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Cancer Prevention Research, and they discovered that throughout the 12-week period, the participants taking the broccoli sprout drink increased the rate of excretion of benzene by 61%. So you say, what's benzene? Well, you know that it's a carcinogen. It comes in the form of car and truck exhaust. Anytime you're in traffic, you're breathing it. Its emissions also come from coal and oil combustion and evaporation of industrial chemicals, like at a gas station. So you also inhale benzene if you're a smoker. In effect, participants who drank a broccoli sprout juice could effectively reverse some of the damage from the carcinogens in the fumes in only 1 month. So how does this impact you? What could we do with this information? It's simple. Broccoli sprouts are rich in indole-3-carbinol and isothiocyanates, some very powerful natural chelators. But so too would be wheatgrass juice. 2 ounces of wheatgrass juice could do more than a cup of broccoli sprouts, but you could have them both together. So too would be arugula, watercress, dandelion greens. They all are very rich in compounds that are natural chelators. But the real superstars of natural chelation would be chlorella and spirulina. These are two single-cell algaes that are rich in chlorophyll, also rich in protein. They have a higher percentage of protein than meat or eggs. So by switching to a vegan, healthy diet, you're not only providing the body with nutrients, but you're also protecting it and getting rid of toxins that we're all exposed to as background. So that's that. In a study that is being presented before a large group of some 7,000 to 10,000 scientists in 2 months from now, I'll be laying out a diet that was provided to a group of menopausal, postmenopausal women. And one of the 57 different criteria that we measured was bone loss, osteoporosis, thinning of the bones. And it will be shown, and it has been shown, that we will reverse it, meaning you remineralize the bone. And that's a very positive thing, so that women didn't have to worry about having a compound fracture, spontaneous fracture. See, people think that they fall and break their hip. The truth is, most people break their hip and fall as a consequence because their bones are so brittle. And you can understand why. When you drink coffee, you can contribute to osteoporosis. Soft drinks absolutely contribute to it. High levels of caffeine contribute to it. Phosphoric acid in soft drinks contributes to it. Diuretics contribute to it. So when you're eating a high acid diet, meat diet, soft drink diet, you're demineralizing your calcium. You're taking it out of the bone. So by eating a wholesome diet, you put it back in. Now, one of the very first things that everyone learned was how to put minerals back into the bones with blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, tart cherries, and pomegranate. It was very beneficial, not just for remineralization of the bones, but across the spectrum. People's hair that had been thinning and falling out stopped and reversed. Hair that was white began to come back its natural color. Women who had underactive thyroid, slow metabolism, gaining weight, fatigue, lost weight and improved their metabolism. People who had fungus under the toenails, ridge and feckles, and little streaks and ridges on the fingernails, the nails became pink, hard, and smooth. Funguses went away. Those are just some of the things from the study. But blueberries and blueberry concentrate was a big part of it. This is the latest. It says, quote, from West Lafayette, Indiana, Purdue University issued a press release, quote, a $3.7 million grant will allow Purdue University researchers to study how blueberries reduce bone loss in postmenopausal women. Quote, we are taking a systemic, deep dive to learn if blueberries are helpful to counter menopause-induced and age-related bone loss, said a distinguished professor and head of the nutrition science. Human studies have not been done before, and this project will also look at what dose levels protect bone. This is one of the most compelling avenues, and for that they're getting a National Institutes of Study $3.7 million. Well, a short note. I think that probably, from my experience, 90% of all university research is nonsense, shouldn't be funded, shouldn't exist. I know an awful lot of academics. Almost any evening when I go up to the health food store to have my evening smoothie, the people in there in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, most are for Columbia University, Barnard, Teachers College, Theological Seminary. These are some pretty bright people. And it's a neighborhood. And it's the one place people can congregate and talk about issues over a juice. And we do all the time. And when you hear people talk about how much money is wasted on research that never should have been, but it looks good for the university, when you can bring in money to the university, it gives you a certain reputation within the system. But it doesn't mean the research is viable, will improve the quality of lives. The vast majority doesn't. Giving $2.7 million to see whether or not blueberries help remineralization, to say that we don't have any other studies, is not correct. There are multiple studies showing the benefits of the polyphenols in fruits in mineralization. I see this all the time, the first study, and it's not the first study. But they don't take the time and effort to look at all the other hundreds of thousands of studies, but we have over 500,000 studies in this office from peer-reviewed literature. That's what's amazing, is when someone, you go into a debate and someone says, well, there's no proof, what type of proof do you need? Well, you have to have a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study published in a peer-reviewed journal, and, well, you don't have it. Well, we have 1,000 of them on that topic. And then you show them the 1,000 studies. And then they say, well, I'm still not convinced. Then you realize you're not dealing with an academic. You're not dealing with a skeptic. You're dealing with a cult member. I just finished an interview just before I came on the air today. A publication that deals in medical issues called me. This is an Orthodox group. And wanted to interview me about some comments I'd made a couple weeks ago at a medical conference where I challenged the doctors. Could I be more specific? And I said, well, I thought I was specific, but I'll be this specific. I said, all of medicine today is, with the exception of emergency medicine, is based upon a false premise. It does not seek to learn natural healing within the body organism, meaning how do we heal? Why does one person get cancer and overcome it, and another person gets cancer and dies? Why does one person get a clogged artery, carotid artery, and another person not if they're both on the same diet? they're not asking the important questions nor doing the research. They're all chasing the golden ring, a pharmaceutical approach to the pathologizing of a particular condition. That's why we have all the monies on chemotherapy or on statins or on antipsychotic medication. I said, what is the standard? And I asked all these hundreds of doctors, what is the standard that you require in order to make change? And the answer was, we want quality studies done at respected institutions, published in respected peer-reviewed journals several times. Okay, I said, you have a gentleman in your midst who did that. Dr. Dean Ornish, published in the New England Journal of Medicine. You don't get any more respect in the United States than that. In the British Medical Journal, published on several different occasions, had his work independently confirmed. I filmed his work at the time, using a vegetarian diet with stress management and supplements to help reverse various forms of heart disease, including deocclusion of the arteries. Now, he wasn't the first doctor to do it, but he was the first doctor to publish studies on it. So I said, here you have someone who almost 30 years ago did all this really seminal work. He followed every single single covenant that you had laid out. No one changed. So if you were honest, you would say, no matter what evidence you give us, we will not change. Then you'd be telling the truth. We do not care about the outcome of the patients. We care about the honoring the protocol. Then you'd be honest. The protocol is dictated by the pharmaceutical people who tell you how to approach a disease, and they give you the remedy. The fact that it doesn't work means that you have to live in denial that you're not getting good results, even if you're being rewarded for your effort. So we have this duality. In America, we reward everyone for their efforts, and we pay no attention to the results. The war on poverty, the war on terror, the war on AIDS, the war on anything, they're all medical Vietnams. They all fail. Every single war fails. But we don't care. It is, our logic is perfect. We reward you for your intent and your effort. And as long as your intent is good and your effort is what is expected, then the results are of no relevance. And that's true of every institution in America, without exception, from religion to education. They're all culpable. I simply brought this, you know, like a mirror with a high wattage light. This is the truth. It doesn't matter what discoveries, as long as those discoveries cannot be patented and controlled within the existing paradigm, they must be denied or simply not recognized. And that's the way it is. So the next time you hear of a university getting a grant to study something, the probability is that there's been a lot of other research in the same field. They're being rewarded for how well they can write grants. And that in itself is an entire cottage industry in the United States. And we pay for it. Next up, artificial sweeteners may cause gut bacteria to change. From Catherine Griffin, she says, artificial sweeteners have long puzzled scientists. While they're supposedly non-caloric, they don't seem to assist in weight loss. Now, researchers may have an explanation. They found that artificial sweeteners may hasten the development of glucose intolerance and metabolic disease by changing the composition and function of gut bacteria. For years, researchers have wondered why non-caloric artificial sweeteners don't help weight loss. In fact, some studies have suggested that they do the opposite and cause weight gain. Determined to get rid of to the bottom line of this issue, researchers did a study on artificial sweeteners, and they came up with the idea that these artificial sweeteners change the nature of the bacteria in the gut, and that changing of the bacterial gut is what prevents the weight loss. So my suggestion, stop with the artificial sweeteners. They're very unhealthy. And finally, the Institute of Environmental Medicine at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden found that that a healthy lifestyle can prevent 80% of heart attacks. They studied people for an average of 11 years, and they looked at everything in their lifestyle. And what they found was that those that took the time to eat right, exercise, and de-stress could prevent 80% of heart attacks. This was published in Journal of the American College of Cardiology. And by the way, they didn't even measure the kind of supplements that we have today, like L-carnitine, magnesium, citrate, coenzyme Q10, NADH, capsicum, that can help prevent a heart attack. So could you imagine if you used all that, how many people could be alive? And finally, I'm sure many of you watched with some amazement as Barack Obama once again explained why that what did he say? He said that no God would allow the Islamic State to exist and slaughter what it considers to be non-believers. His statement follows the same line of transgression committed by Bill Clinton and George W. Bush in their baleful appeals to God and Christ, even as these approved and presided over operations leading to torture and rape and murder and wounding of large swaths of the humanity. And this sinful vanity, the claim to know God's will. How many times have we heard that? It's precisely the sin that the Islamic State Caliphate and the House of Saud and the Vatican and the Church of England and all stripes of religious sects worshiping prophets and gods make each and every day in the name of good. According to John Stanton, take a look at the Russian author of Life and Fate, Vasily Grossman, for a lesson on good and evil as the civil military leaders of the 21st century appeal to their gods to sanction suffering, censure, torture, murder, and the creation of gulags, large and small. Quote, few people ever attempt to define good. What is good? Good for whom? Is there a common good? The same for all people, all tribes, all conditions of life. Or is my good your evil? Is what is good for my people evil for your people? Is good eternal and constant? Or is yesterday's good today's vice? Yesterday's evil today's good? When the last judgment approaches, not only philosophers and preachers, but everyone on earth, literate or illiterate, will ponder the nature of good and evil. Have people advanced over the millennia in their concept of good? Is this concept something that is common to all people, both Greeks and Jews, as the apostle supposed? To all classes, nations, and states, even to all animals, trees, and mosses. As Buddha and his disciples claim, the same Buddha who had to deny life in order to clothe in the goodness and love. Okay, well, let's take a look at this. First, the Christian view, 5 centuries after Buddhism, restricted the living world to which the concept of good is applicable. Not every living thing, only human beings. The good of the first Christians, which had embraced all mankind, in turn gave way to a purely Christian good. The good of the Muslims was not distinct. Centuries passed, and the good of Christianity split it into the distinct goods of Catholicism, the goods of Protestantism, the good of Orthodoxy. And the good of Orthodoxy gave birth to the distinct goods of the old and the new beliefs. At the same time, there was the good of the poor and the good of the rich, the goods of the whites, the blacks, the yellow races. And more goods came into being, corresponding to each sect, each cult, each race, each class. Everyone outside a particular magic circle was excluded. Sorry, you're not on the good. People began to realize how much blood had been spilled in the name of a petty, doubtful good. in the name of the struggle of this petty good against what is believed to be evil. Sometimes the very concept of good became a scourge, a greater evil than evil itself. Good of this kind is a mere husk from which the sacred kernel has been lost. Who can reclaim the lost kernel? But more fundamental, what is good? It used to be said that it is a thought and a related action which lead to a greater strength or triumph of humanity, or of a family, or a nation, or a state, or class, or a faith. People struggling for this particular good always attempt to dress it up as a universal good. They say, my good coincides with the universal good. My good is essential not only to me, but to everyone. In achieving my good, I serve the universal good. And so the good of a sect, a class, a nation, or a state assumes a specious universality in order to justify its struggle against an apparent evil. Even Herod did not shed blood in the name of evil. He shed blood in the name of his particular good. A new force had come into the world, a force that threatened to destroy him and his family, to destroy his friends and his favorites, his kingdom and his armies. But it was not evil that had been born. It was Christianity. Humanity had never before heard such words, judge not, that thee be judged. For with that judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with that measure ye mete, it shall be measured to you again. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Therefore, all things whatsoever ye would be that man should do, do ye even so to them, for this is the law of the prophets. We've heard that. And what did this doctrine of peace and love bring to humanity? The tortures of the Inquisition, the struggles against heresy in France, Italy, Flanders, and Germany, the conflict between Protestantism and Catholicism, the intrigues of the monastic orders, the conflict between the different philosophies, the crushing yoke that lay for centuries over science and freedom, the Christians who wiped out the heathen population of Tasmania, the scoundrels who burnt whole villages in Africa. This doctrine caused more suffering than all the crimes of the people who did evil for its own sake. In great hearts, the cruelty of life gives birth to good. They then seek to carry this good back into life, hoping to make life itself accord with their inner image of good. But life never changes to accord with an image of good. Instead, it is the image of good that sinks into the mirror of life to lose its universality, to split into fragments and be exploited by the needs of the day. People are wrong to see life as a struggle between good and evil. Those who most wish for the good of humanity are unable to diminish evil by one jot. Great ideas are necessary in order to dig new channels, to remove stones, to bring down cliffs and fell forests. Dreams of universal good are necessary in order that great waters should flow in harmony. Yes, if the sea was able to think, then every storm would make its waters dream of happiness. Each wave breaking against the cliff would believe it was dying for the good of the sea. It would never occur to it that, like thousands of waves before and after, it had only been brought into being by the wind. Many books have been written about the nature of good and evil and the struggle between them. There's a deep and undeniable sadness to all this. Whenever we see the dawn of an external concept that tells us there's an eternal good that will never be overcome by evil, an evil that in and itself is eternal, but will never succeed in overcoming good. Whenever we see this dawn, the blood of old people and children is always shed. Not only men, but even those in the most powerful, those that interpret the good and evil, and what we can and cannot do, go forth and say, in the name of good, we must purge. Now just think simply. Think of the 650,000 children that Madeleine Albright said were okay to have died for a common good. Was it worth it? That's the good. Did she know any of those 650,000 children who died because of sanctions from Hillary and Bill Clinton's policies? No, she never met any of them. Did you ever feel remorse? When you have good on your side, you don't have to feel remorse because the other is not good, or you would not have victimized it. The very idea that we do not have to apologize ever for anything that we do against other people is the bane of those who deal in the land of the good. Now the horror of German fascism has arisen. The air is full of the groans and cries of the condemned. The sky has turned black. The sun has been extinguished by the smoke of gas ovens. And even these crimes never before seen in the universe, even by man on earth, have been committed in the name of good. Once the thought was that good was to be found neither in man nor in the predatory world of animals and insects, but in the silent kingdom of the trees. Far from it. What about the forced slow movement, the treacherous way that it battled against grass and the bushes for each inch of soil? First, billions of seeds flying through the air and beginning to sprout, destroying the grass and the bushes. Then millions of victorious shoots wage war against one another. That is how it is seen by the determinist, the reductionist, those who believe that one species supersedes its capacities and becomes dominant and deserves that dominant position. So think of this in the most practical sense. Those who are the weakest do not deserve anything but contempt because they are weak, and therefore the common good is served when they are kept in their place. You are stopped and searched because you represent a threat to society, an existential threat to society. Therefore, the larger masses have never protested. The whites in every community in America, the rich whites, the super rich whites, the educated whites, the school teacher whites, the professor whites, they have not come together and protested in New York City, the 650,000 blacks and Latinos in 1 year, because what? Why? Ask them. Because you believe in a common good, and somehow those who've been profiled come from the not good, the other, the evil? How do we justify racism? How do we justify misogyny? How do we justify that which is so counterintuitive and counterproductive to anything representing spiritual? And yet our synagogues, our mosques, our churches, our chapels are filled with nothing but hypocrites who believe that because they sit there, because they go through in some form of incantation or some ritualized prayer that they know nothing of, that they are on the side of good. The private kindness of one individual towards another, a petty, thoughtless kindness, you may say, an unwitnessed kindness, others will say, something we could all call senseless kindness, a kindness outside any system, a social, religious good. Why do we think in such terms? Because we will seek to be kind to those that support us or like us, are in our image, our beliefs, but we choose not to be kind to those who are different. We choose to be unkind because they do not meet our social, educational, political, ideological standing. Who gives us the right? If you're not perfect, why do you think you have a right to criticize anyone? And yet we do, as if by the mere fact our belief systems, our ideology provides us with a podium to criticize and condemn. I've seen as much hypocrisy on the airwaves of this station and its parent company than I have in anything in the mainstream media. And we consider ourselves above it. We are not above it. We are as below as anyone else when we take it upon ourselves to promote, as one popular program did, the destruction of Libya and of Syria. And what was your rationale? And what became of the consequences? Did you think that you were pure and above reproach because your intent was noble? Did you look at the results? Have you taken responsibility? If you did, then you'd be off the airwaves. You would resign and go live in a monastery. That is how we live today. And hence, we do not have to worry about others. We do not have to worry if we're in a shelter, air conditioned in the Arizona desert, playing a video game, except the outcome of this video game is a drone will kill a wedding family. It will cause the destruction and the decapitation of dozens of individuals. We will be rewarded for our efforts. And in this case, we'll be especially rewarded for the results. We killed terrorists. Did we? Did we have a court, a trial, evidence? It was all specious. We had nothing on our side except power. And that is how we use power today, ruthlessly, as an object. And that is not, I believe, how we should be approaching our problems. John Stanton, I'm not alone in these thoughts. I want you now to hear from an individual who has something to say, a veteran of the Iraqi-Afghan conflict.
Well, I don't agree at all. First off, how is it possible that anybody with any kind of sanity would consider the United States or Britain or the West in general to be in any kind of position to be punishing anyone for any illegalities? If we want to take a look at Iraq, there is at least 1 million, probably even close to 2 million dead. We invaded that country, destroyed it, created millions of orphans, millions of refugees, and never even so much as apologized for that. Let's go back to Vietnam, where we dropped 20 million bombs, more than all of World War II combined. We have destroyed so many countries. We have tortured and killed and maimed and raped around this planet. Who in the hell in their right mind would consider the United States or the West in general to be in any position to punish anybody? Never mind the obvious facts that this is a false flag attack and a long list of false flag attacks, which let's get into that, please. Well, we don't operate under international law. What we have is the color of law, the law of the jungle, in which the rich and the powerful basically determine what goes and what doesn't go. Iraq is a perfect example of that. Why isn't Tony Blair and George Bush rotting away in a prison cell for the rest of their lives? Because the law is not being applied. These are war criminals, and they should be in prison for the rest of their lives, if not executed, if their own rules were adhered to for their own crimes. Not only that, but we need to really understand the truth here. First off, all of these players, these politicians, are nothing more than puppets. They don't serve the people. There is no real democracy. They really serve the rich and powerful who run the world, and that would be the bankers who control the money supply. The bankers, of course, make huge amounts of money. Whether they make bad investments or not, wars are great for them, and ultimately they control the politicians, and that is why we see these policies. Obama and Cameron are nothing more than puppets who read the script, and the script is, we need another war. And the reason why we need another war, according to these psychopaths who are running the world, is because more and more people, despite the clueless masses who continue to be entranced by things so ridiculous as X Factor and American Idol, there is larger numbers of people around the world who are realizing the truth and beginning to recapture the capacity to think for themselves. And they can see that these people who are being put in positions of public trust are defying that trust and representing an agenda which they could never speak about openly because they're nothing more than prostitutes and nothing more than minions for the powers that be. Well, the Greater Israel Project is all about destabilizing surrounding nations, ultimately in pursuit of this dream of Greater Israel from the Euphrates down to the Nile, all the way over to the Eastern Mediterranean. This is the dream of these psychopaths, and so destabilizing governments, creating sectarian strife, is all part of that menu and all part of the design to create Greater Israel. So that goes... it's self-evident. But I have to go back to what this gentleman is saying in Washington, D.C. about America not wanting to get involved or Obama not getting involved. What are you talking about? We have been arming people directly who are al-Qaeda. Al-Nusra Front is al-Qaeda. These people are psychopaths to the worst order. They're conducting suicide attacks. They're gassing people. We know Carla Del Ponte said in May that it was the so-called rebels in Syria that were using sarin gas. Not the Bashar al-Assad regime. No, it was not. We know that the United States president is arming people who are on the U.S. terrorist list. He should be convicted of aiding and abetting, giving material support to a terrorist organization. But then again, you know what? We, the West, the United States in particular, Israel and Britain, are the biggest terrorists on the planet. So our little junior partners in al-Qaeda, which is nothing more than a CIA database, thus the name Al-Qaeda. This is nothing more than a group of terrorists working together, each playing one different role, but all of them working together for the same goal, which is to maintain this hideous and sick and twisted, unjust world that we have, which is a perpetual state of war. Always one illusion, one boogeyman after another. But the fact is, Obama is nothing more than a puppet war criminal, just like his predecessor and every other U.S. president before him. So please don't tell people out there that the U.S. is not involved. It's directly involved, and it is arming people who are absolute psychopaths. Because the United States has never been interested in anything.
Kendall, keep going.
Has never been interested in anything other than war. The United States is in a perpetual state of war because the bankers control the politicians and they read the script as given to them by the banksters and they make huge amounts of money off of this. What this gentleman is saying about the United States not wanting war, not wanting to get involved is like Iraq 2.0. It's a repeat of the same rubbish that was said, oh, we don't want war, war is a last resort. That's absolutely untrue. It's a lie. Those that are in government are nothing more than prostitutes who are carrying out the orders of those who are in charge of them, and those that are in charge want another war. And part of that is what we discussed earlier, the Greater Israel Project, to destabilize any Arab regime which might have any kind of autonomy and self-determination. Any regime in the Arab world that is not an absolute puppet cannot be tolerated. And who are the nations that we target? Those that are not puppets. We don't target those like the Saudi regime, which is the biggest human rights violator in that region. It's cutting off people's heads in public, cutting off hands. It is the most grotesque regime on the planet, and yet we give that regime weapons, and it's no problem whatsoever. The duplicity and hypocrisy of the United States and the West can't even be measured. It is so enormous. And these mouthpieces, such as this gentleman in Washington, is only doing a disservice to himself and his country. And the fact is that American sons and daughters will get involved in this yet again, and these chicken hawks who are pretending to care about the Syrian people are going to be sacrificing not their own sons and daughters. I would like this man to send his sons and daughters and his grandchildren off to Syria when this turns into a greater conflict, because this is what we're flirting with, is a world war, a third world war. This is not a joke. We are flirting with a third world war on the basis that apparently we care so much about the Syrian people, just like we care so much about the Iraqi people and the Afghani people. The only people that buy this sort of stuff are either bought off prostitutes or the dumbest of the dumb. And we're also led to believe that Assad is the dumbest idiot dictator on the planet now, isn't he? Because he invited UN inspectors to come in, and he brought them in on the very day that they come in. He decides to attack his own people 10 miles away from where the inspectors arrive. This is beyond ridiculous. And the only people that buy this, again, are bought off prostitutes or the dumbest of the dumb. Well, there's no question that they don't intend for limited strikes, and that's not going to do anything. They weren't going to go in full scale. That's the plan. Of course, they'll use pretext to be able to justify the initial attack, and then they'll concoct more things to justify a greater involvement. The Daily Mail reported here in the UK, and it's commonly understood to those who are paying attention, that defense contractors, leaked emails from defense contractors, proved that there was already an approved plan from Obama down to give these psychopath terrorists al-Nusra Front chemical weapons. We know that al-Nusra Front, 12 individuals in Turkey were caught with 2 kilos of sarin gas. Where did they get that from? And this is, you know, clearly a false flag. We understand this to be true, and it's the only way that they could justify an attack at all. And I have to say, I'm happy that the gentleman in Washington mentioned Dempsey, General Dempsey of the Joint Chiefs, because I'll tell you what, more than anything else, it is the true American patriots, those who are sick and tired of having given up their life to basically serve the American dream, the American nation, the Constitution that they swore to uphold. It's those military men and women. It's you now. It's coming to you now. Are you a patriot or are you not? Are you going to let your nation descend even further into the chaos and corruption that has been so sick and so twisted that it's destroying American lives as well as the rest of the world to the tune of 22 American servicemen a day who are committing suicide? Are you going to sacrifice more of your American sons and daughters for Israeli wars, for Zionist wars? Are you going to continue to do that? Because you are not a patriot. You are, in fact, aiding and abetting the terrorists you supposedly think you're fighting against. And those Americans who are waking up to this, I hope to God, in the military in particular, that you refuse your orders. And this is why the people of America who are refusing to buy this nonsense, the overwhelming majority do not support any kind of attack on Syria. And those in the military, I know that the powers that be are very, very frightened that high ups within the military will refuse use the orders. And I hope this is exactly what happens if an attack on Syria occurs.
Very well. We're going to leave it there. Thank you very much. Former U.S. Marine and war veteran there, Ken O'Keefe, talking to us from London.
Ken O'Keefe.
And thank you very much.
Now we're going to do our talkback segment. You have an opportunity to call in and share your questions, comments, thoughts, and points of view. Our number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I had asked you earlier in the program how much our legislators make, and the amount is $608 an hour. That's $608 an hour. Wow. So they're making a lot of money for what? What do they do on our behalf? Let's say hello to Luann Panessi, who is standing by, and then we'll take your calls as they're coming in. And also I want to get to a Mississippi suit over hellish conditions in for-profit prisons. I think we have a moral responsibility to ask, what happens when we put people in prison? Do we have any intention of rehabilitating them, have them reenter society? What about those who are nonviolent offenders, those who have just been caught using what all of our past three presidents have used, drugs, and they are spending decades in prison? Do we care about them? Do we care about anyone? If so, who? Because the prison system is a disgrace. We'll go into that in a moment. Let's say hello to Luann. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, I'm sure you were waiting for this question, and here it is. This comes from Sarah from Wisconsin. She says, I used to live in New York. I listened for about 15 years, and now I listen over the Internet to PRN. And her big question for you is, how would you handle the ISIS crisis?
I would not use violence, because for every son, every father you kill, you create 10 potential jihadists. That's simply a matter of reality. Or put it a different way, what would happen to you, Luann? You come from an extended family. If people in your family were tortured, arrested, harassed, killed, detained without trial for years, would you be angry at the people who are doing it? Would you want
Absolutely.
To fight back?
Yes. Yes.
So let us not be hypocritical. You get the average person angry about who wins a baseball or basketball or soccer game, they're willing to take your head off. So we now have to look at what happens when we've had decades of systemic exploitation of a group of people with no rule of law. That's number one. So who could solve the problem? Well, first, you can't solve any problem unless you're willing to acknowledge how you evolved the problem. We evolved the problem because, and since World War II, we have engaged in 58 separate regime changes around the world. From South America, Central America, we had the group of people that we would send into a country that would then tell them, like a John Perkins, who would say he was an economic hitman. He would go in and speak with the president or leader of a country, and he would say, we're going to give you unlimited amounts of money. You can exploit your own population. We will see that you're never arrested. You're never prosecuted. There will be no crime against humanity to you. You can hide your money in our banks, or we'll see that nothing happens if you hide it in Swiss banks. In return, we want complete exploitation of the labor force. We do not want any regulations. We do not want any land redistribution. We do not want unions. We do not want representation. And if the person says yes, they're rewarded. If they say no, they are killed. Now, that's not me saying that. That's John Perkins, who was one of dozens of people, all of whom knew each other, who worked out of the CIA and state. So only when we recognize that we have destabilized regime change to create client governments, clients of the United States, and hence major corporations. We did this in Afghanistan. We did it in Iraq. There were no weapons of mass destruction, but they had planned this for years before. Therefore, when you have caused the death of 650,000 children, and you realize you have about 40 people per extended family, when you've caused displacement outside the country of 2 to 3 million and 5 to 6 million inside the country, when you realize you've killed between 150,000 at the very low, and no one believes that figure, more likely 1 1.5 million, which is more realistic, then that means every single family in Iraq has been impacted and affected. Also, when you completely deny any part in the ruling or administration or the bureaucracy of a country, the Sunni, that represents anywhere at from 65 to 70% of the total population, and you give it exclusively to your hand-picked puppet, and that is a kleptocracy where tens of billions of dollars go into private accounts and all the contract work is done by favoritism and no one benefits and the country becomes completely failed. That is the poverty and the failure and the lack of future is what breeds those young people, principally young people, going off to fight in these cells. Now, that's so at least we know where they come from. Separately, what is the most powerful force able to stop ISIS in the Middle East? It is Iran. Iran has nearly 1 million member army trained in urban warfare because they've been fearing the attack from Israel. There is no proof of them making an atomic bomb, irrespective of what the neocons would like you to believe, and they have invaded no one. All the while, those who have invaded, like, look at the invasion of Libya by Great Britain and France and the United States through NATO, our proxy. They've invaded no one. Now, they have created their own police and their own armed conflict people, Hezbollah. But they, if allowed to go in and confront ISIS, they would decimate ISIS. They are more than capable of destroying ISIS. But we can't allow that because we also know that the most powerful man in Iraq is not the president of Iraq. It is the future imam who's going to be the spiritual leader. He's now number two, but he will be number one in time. And he was trained for his spiritual teachings in Iran, Muqtada Sadr. We do not want the Shia in Iran and the Shia in Iraq joining in a unity. We want to keep them polarized. But that would be that. Also, it is not our battle. It is the battle of Saudi Arabia that has been training jihadists and terrorists for more than 20 years and does so now. And was implicit in the planning of the major group were Saudis in the 9/11 attacks. You have to look at the countries that are complicit in training. Turkey. Turkey has not officially gone against ISIS because it's been training ISIS and funding them. You don't end up with these giant incomes per day simply by selling oil. Who are they selling the oil to? Instead of destroying the oil refineries and causing massive environmental fires, why don't you just say by your satellites and your intelligence, which countries are buying the oil that the ISIS or the Islamic State controls? Put a boycott on them. We're not doing that because those are also our allies. You think these people are selling this on the open market? Do you think that there's not a complete channel of where every single drop of that oil goes, whether it's from Libya or from any of the stolen oil? Of course we know where it goes, but we're not dealing with the cause. So if you took the Arab League nations and you had them come together and you look for a political settlement and you look to allow governments in each country to have representation and you took the money you were putting into destroying them and you put it into rebuilding the countries and giving jobs and allowing the people to have the culture, the custom that they believe in their different regions, you would end this. Now, that will take time, but in the end, this is not America's fight and never has been. But we want to dominate the fight so we can control the outcome. With all these ships and the intelligence and the satellites, with all the special forces that we had in Vietnam, after all those years in Vietnam, and we were there when the French was there funding them and getting advisors from the late 1950s right through to 1973, we didn't win. Mind you, we were fighting an army that had no ships, no satellites, no airplanes, no vehicles. Their vehicle was primarily bicycles and old vintage guns. They won. Putting more Americans at risk spending more money, creating more caskets would not have caused us to win. You don't fight a war on terrorism by destroying it the way we're trying to and have. This is where we're misguided. We need a different approach. We also need to get the religious leaders within Islam to come forward and have a unified approach showing that the rules that they're using, that ISIS is using, has nothing to do with Islam. That this is a self-serving group that is trying to use a religion for its own political outcomes. And it is their movement, the people who are following Islam at the highest standard of Islam, that would be able to unify the billion. There's difference of opinion whether it's 1.3 billion or 1.8 billion, but somewhere between 1.3 and 1.8 billion people, you have religious leaders that seek the virtues of peace, of justice without brutality, jihad within Islam. They should be leading the religious effort to unify all the other Islamic believers, and you should have the nations involved seeking to establish a diplomacy where those who've been excluded, including the Sunnis, are included, and then rebuilding the infrastructures within the community so people have quality of life, none of which we're doing. We're doing just the opposite. And because we're doing the opposite, we can't reasonably expect anything but just more waste of human life, resources, for nothing. Hope that answers the question. Thank you, Noanne. And we're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Let's say hello to the people on the line now. Real quick, we'll go to Gene from New Jersey. Gene, your turn.
Hello, Mr. Gary. Real quick. Today was one of the best shows that I had ever heard on your show. And the soldier that spoke, what you spoke about racism, you know, there's a lot of people that go along with you when the diets and the health food. But when you start speaking about other truth, people shut their radio off. They don't want to hear it. But I thank you so much for being on this planet and speaking your truth. Gary, I love you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Gene. Let's say hello to Dominic from Long Island. Hi, Dominic.
Hi, Gary. Did you mention that King Herod was actually doing for the good of his kingdom, I guess? I think that was actually selfishness on his part, and selfishness is a part of evil. So it's not the good of God. It's the good of his own selfishness.
It was merely a metaphor.
It
was meant to show selfishness.
Yeah. Well, I just figured I'd, in case, not the way I understood it, but whatever.
Okay.
Good is never evil.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Dominic. Kevin from New York. Kevin, your turn.
Thank you, Gary. Just two quick points. The second in command of Iraq's Air Force, General Sada, he was 40 years in the Iraq Air Force. He was second in command. He wrote a book, and he said that they put the weapons on passenger airplanes that had their seats removed. He describes the entire process. He says that the weapons were moved to Syria on these planes. This is a general, second in command. The second point is, Gary, I'm waiting for the left to acknowledge that there are millions of girls in school in Afghanistan, and the women there are asking us to stay. They're pleading with Fawzia Koofi, Gary, read her book, Favorite Daughter, left out in the sun to die on the day she was born, struggled her whole life to become a doctor, ran for president. She's never been interviewed on Hypocrisy Now once. The women there are acknowledging that they've benefited from us, and I just heard this raving maniac on your show say that we've done nothing but hurt them. And I'm fed up with it, Gary. I'm sorry. But I'm sick of this with the left. Come on. You guys got to be fair. All
okay,
right?
Okay. First of all, where did you get that I'm the left?
Okay. Okay.
Question.
Where did you get
that I'm the left?
I understand. But
have you heard how critical I am of the left?
Yes, I have. I agree. Yes, I
and,
agree.
And we do not deal in absolutes. We deal in specific arguments. When someone is saying what we have done against a society, we have to look at the larger impact we've had on a society And when the larger impact has been negative, it does not negate that specific...
Well, can you invite her on the show, Gary?
Of course.
She'll take your call.
Of
her name is Fazia Kufi. She was on Jon Stewart's show. You can Google it. She's saying that Jay Leno, before he retired, Gary, Jay Leno brought George Bush on. He went to Iraq, Jay Leno. And he brought him on to acknowledge. If you watch part four of the interview with Jay Leno and George Bush, he said they show the progress that was made there. And it's a real progress. Angelina Jolie went there with Jay Leno. They saw the progress. And he said Bush deserves some credit for that. And Bush says it to the audience.
Hold on. We're out of time. We're out of time. But keep in mind, those were staged, completely controlled visits. No different than John McCain going into, after the surge, showing how it worked, walking down a street, talking with people, smiling on the market. They brought in chickens that day in crates so that it would look, and produce, where there had been none. They had over 300 soldiers on rooftops and in gunships above that you didn't see or hear to protect McCain. It was a staged event. They've done nothing but stage events. But we will be happy to talk about the progress made to the degree it has been by the women in Afghanistan, but Afghanistan is a misogynist country where women do not have power. They should, and we're always emphasizing power to women. Thank you very much for your call. Let's say hello to you, Trees Lead. Hi, you Trees.
Hi, Gary. Today we're talking about the Wizard of Odd. President Obama thinks there's no place like home.
We're going to be listening to you, Trees Lead, right now.
Gary Null Show's executive producer is Richard Gale. Our program director is Jason Taubenfeld. The archive team is Sharon Pride and Casey Holford. And our head engineer is Giselle Hernandez. You can download past programs by visiting our archives at prn.fm.